This is Karen Lyle of Salesport Talk. SailGP's Australian team, led by Tom Slingsby, did a stunning comeback to seize victory in a day of nail-biting shoreside racing in Dubai.
I guess we're a bit up and down, our team. Everyone knows it's all about confidence. And Friday's practice racing, we felt like we're unstoppable. And then we hit yesterday and we got brought down to earth pretty quickly. And then today we had a tough start, but we just built the momentum and we hit that final and we said we've got a good shot at this. And what a final. I don't really know what happened, if I'm honest. It's all a blur. I remember the last top mark where we all compressed again, but unreal.
So around the last gate to go upwind, you decided to follow the French. Were you going to bank second and Ben took the risk and went the other way?
Yeah, I actually was thinking that. I was like, okay, well, let's try to take the favoured mark and try to lock in a second here. And then Ben actually gained out of going to the other mark, which wasn't favoured all day, but he saw it and he made a good opportunity and got back into it. So, like, literally, I was thinking at times, oh, maybe we'll bank second here. I never for one second thought we're actually going to get to the win, even at, like, till 20 seconds before the finish. So it was a bit of a shock.
What were you thinking coming into that final top gate where you had rights on the French boat?
I knew we had rights, but I also knew it was a tough move to tack inside, and I knew that even though we had starboard tack, we had to give it away to, we weren't laying the left turn, so we had this a tough manoeuvre coming up. So I knew I wanted to get France on starboard, and I looked at GBR and I thought there's no way he's going to lay that mark. So, but then when we came out of the tack, we were just avoiding a luff from the French, and then all of a sudden I saw Ben in there, and they just made the lay line and they got to the top mark first, and then it was a final scramble down the last run.
Do you think that was the most intense final you've raced?
Oh, for sure, for sure. That's the most crazy race I've ever had probably in 30 years.
Yeah, unbelievable.
mate, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Good race.
Good race.
Mate, good race. Yeah, I don't know. It was all a blur, but God, it was fun. Yeah, I feel for GBR because they sailed so well and got to the lead, and it was unfortunate they couldn't get. I assume they couldn't get their board on the lock in the last jibe, and but we stayed in it and we gave ourselves a chance, and we got a bit lucky.
What does this win mean for the team?
It's been a while since we've won an event. We've sort of been sort of thereabouts, and we've been consistent. And literally going into today, we were like saying, okay, let's just try to get back one or two points. We're in eighth position. If we can get away with a sixth or a fifth, that's not a bad result. Like, salvage the event. And then after the second race today, we were like, we've got a chance at this. We're up to six overall with an opportunity to get into third. We need the points to go our way. And they went our way, and we got into it.
Thank you, Tom. This is Karen Lyle of Salesport Talk.
Thank you for that, Chris Cross. Welcome back to the show. Rick Tittle with you coast to coast and around the world on the American Forces Radio Network. What we do on Tuesdays at 9:40 Pacific Time is I bring in a co-host for this segment, Karen Lyle, and it's down to her SailSportTalk.com site, and we always bring someone interesting from the world of sailing as well. First of all, Karen, how are you doing? Welcome back.
Oh, I'm doing just fantastic, and how about yourself, Rick?
Not too shabby. Let's get right to brass tacks, and we'll bring in our guest. It is Jerry Roberts, who is an author, historian, museum consultant as well. Jerry, welcome to the show. I know that you've worked on the Intrepid Sea Air Space Museum there on the Hudson, and last December for Army-Navy Radio Row, I did my show from the hangar deck, and as the son of a former naval officer, that was one of the great thrills of my career. What an outstanding museum that is.
Yeah, it was a really great place. I spent 18 years there. It was an adventure in a lot of different ways.
Jerry, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. And it seems that you are not only a maritime historian, but you also have captured the views from the air and really love to fly as well. Tell us a little bit about some of the books that you have published, because you have several here, and what took you into the writing part of things and photographs.
Sure. Well, I've always been a storyteller. I've always loved adventure, history, etc. The first book I did was The Amazing Book of Paper Boats. It was introducing the history and technology of things that float for kids, and kids could actually make 18 paper boats that all would actually function. The sailboat sailed, etc. And then in Connecticut, where I live now, Connecticut River is the longest river in New England, and I teamed up with a pilot, and we photographed the entire 410 miles of the river and wrote the stories of all of the New England towns along this river that, that flows from the Canadian border through four states and into the ocean. So that was a great project. And I've also done a book on the War of 1812 here in Connecticut. The British attacked our coast several times and, in fact, attacked the town where I lived, where I live now.
So looking, as you have, underwater for shipwrecks off the East Coast, what are some of your prize moments and discoveries?
Sure. Well, there's a very large American warship. It's 500 feet long, sunk by a German U-boat during World War One. It's called the USS San Diego, and it sunk off the coast of Long Island, and I did a lot of diving on that. And it was truly a feeling of going places where few people go. This isn't a sport diving thing. This is deep, deep into a wreck and deep underwater. So, you know, I love that aspect. And I've often told people, because I've sailed all my life and continue to do so, that I like boats whether on the surface and even when they're underwater. I like them on the surface better, especially I'm in them. But yeah, there's a lot of things to see in shipwrecks.
Well, I'm curious, when you did this book, The Connecticut River from the Air, what type of plane were you in? I know that when I have done some helicopter shoots, we have to take the door off so that the photographer can kind of hang out and get a really good view. But if you're inside the plane and you don't have the ability to take the door off, sometimes you have the prop and other things that are interfering. How do you get good pictures?
So the pilot photographer, Tom Walsh, who actually is a former Marine jet fighter pilot and now flies for Delta, so he had at the time a Piper Cub, and we would fly with the doors off. You can actually take the doors off of the aircraft or fold them back. So he never, ever shoots through glass. And then for a while, he also used a seaplane, and you could push the canopy back. And it was all handheld, but with a stabilized camera, a gyroscopic stabilized camera, but handheld. And he would actually photograph as he was flying, and I would be pointing out different things to try to get shots of. And then we ended up probably. Yeah, it was pretty exciting. Pretty exciting.
Is there sort of a holy grail, you know, like Mary Rose, like is there a ship that you're looking for and you're close but you can't find it just yet?
So, you know, I had the opportunity a few years back at a conference to speak to Clive Cussler before he passed away, and he was the great, great wreck hunter. And I asked him that very question, is there one last ship to be found? And he said it's the Bonhomme Richard, which was John Paul Jones'
right.
ship that down after he had defeated the British.
The Serapis. Yeah.
Well, you know, I was intrigued a little bit by this book that you've written, The British Raid on Essex. Because of the role of the American privateers, and if you could tell, I mean, my understanding of that having is that the privateers were really what helped win the American Revolution because of us not really having much of a navy and such an impact that they made on the commercial interests of England. So what is your understanding, knowing much more about this, as to how this particular burning of the American privateers in the Connecticut River impacted the whole situation that we had at that time in 1812?
Sure. So privateers, it's been going on for a long time, and people can confuse them with pirates. They're not pirates at all. They are government-sanctioned. They fly national flags. The crews, the officers are uniformed. They're basically privately owned warships which get licenses from the government, in this case the American government, to attack enemy shipping. You'd never want to sink the enemy ship. You'd want to capture it because the ship and its cargo would then be sold at auction, and that money would be split between the officers, the crew, and the investors behind the ship. And along the coast here in New England, where we had a lot of shipping, all the shipping was shut down by the British during both wars, basically, the Revolution and the War of 1812. So these shipping people would turn to building privateers to try to go out and instead of making a living carrying cargo, intercept some British merchant ships. And it certainly had an effect. The biggest effect it probably had was diverting British warships from other tasks to try to protect the British merchant ships. So it definitely tapped their resources.
You think about the War of 1812 and how it went on for many years after that, and as the privateers of petty pog, as you wrote, who was the traitor that led those Royal Marines up the river?
The name was, we didn't know. It was long. It took us several years to find it out. His name ended up being Ezekiel Jackson. He was probably an American down-and-out seaman who was captured by the British when he was trying to blow up a British ship that was blockading New London. And under threat of death, he agreed to guide the British up into Essex, which was then called Pettipog, to get the privateers that were being built here. And he, he was paid very well. He was paid $2,000. And at that time, for $2,000, you could buy a very significant country estate and staff it for years. So he made out well, but he could never come ashore in America again. And in the end, we learned that he was lost at sea. So he got his reward in the end, I guess.
Well, right during the middle of the pandemic, which we didn't plan on, of course, was the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower's landing that took place in 1620. And I know that that was a big deal where people were planning for years in advance for this anniversary.
Yes.
How did the pandemic affect that, and how did the Mayflower Heritage Center and other organizations that were coordinating for the celebrations handle those commemorative activities?
Sure. As someone who's been involved with several Mayflower organizations, and I'm on the board of a couple, we've been planning this for years. And I went up to Mystic Seaport and, observed the restoration of the Mayflower II that was to be brought back, and all of these big, big events that were planned. And, of course, the pandemic pretty much shut that down. Huge amounts of energy and money probably were, I'm not saying lost, but certainly it didn't get the attention we hoped it would get. On the other hand, we carry on. I'm actually doing a Mayflower talk tomorrow night. But yes, it had a huge impact. It was sort of the biggest 400 years doesn't come that often. And it happens that this 400-year anniversary came right smack in the middle of the pandemic. People still acknowledged it, but we didn't get the tens of thousands of people that you might have gotten for something like this.
You know, you think about that raid, just going back again, and of course, we don't like to remember, and no country likes to remember defeats or such things, but do you think had you not been from that neck of the woods that we would continue to have this sort of thing lost? Why was this something that most historians didn't even know about?
The War of 1812 was sort of wedged between the American Revolution, the glory of the American Revolution, and the national tragedy of the Civil War. And the War of 1812 was wedged in between those two. It lasted 2 years and 8 months, and it ended with no victory for anyone. England didn't win anything. We didn't win anything. There was no exchange of territory. It's just that both sides realized, what the heck are we fighting for? We're actually trading partners. And they ended the war, and they got back to business trading. The big winners were probably the Canadians. America attacked Canada 10 times during the War of 1812, mm-hmm. thinking that we could, quote-unquote, liberate Canada. And as it turns out, Canada did not want to be liberated. But we all got back to business and started shipping each other merchandise again and made a lot of money together. So it was an odd war.
I probably said one of the biggest winners was Andrew Jackson after the Battle of New Orleans, turned that into a presidency. That wasn't too bad.
Yep. And of course, that battle was fought after the war was over.
Right.
But because of the length of time it took to get the word from Europe, where the treaty was signed, back to America. They fought a major battle that had no effect on the war whatsoever.
That was the Iron Duke's brother-in-law, right? General Packnum was leading those troops. Yeah.
Yep.
Karen, you know. We got time for one more question here as you're talking to two history nerds. Go ahead.
You bet. Well, you know, today we have a real great friendship between the United States Navy and the Royal Navy. And we've had a couple of guests on here, retired Rear Admiral John Bidoff from the U.S. Navy and also John McAnally from the Royal Navy. And that friendship that came out of perhaps some lost wars and realizing the common interest, how is that manifest today in your historical remembrances? Do you also collaborate with, you know, other with England on some of these things as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And for this British Red on Ethics project, it was a huge project, and I was able to hire some researchers in England. So I tapped into a lot of folks over there. They had really better records of the battle than we did. So the Royal Navy Archives was a big help. And of course, you know, we share not just a common language, we share a common ancestry. The traditions of the United States Navy largely come from the Royal Navy. And so a lot in common. You know, one of the things that the Intrepid is, we had Fleet Week there, and the Royal Navy came and visited. In fact, the Ark Royal, the aircraft carrier, after it came back from the Falklands, came and visited us at the Intrepid, and it was really great to talk to those folks. So, yeah, we've had a very shared history and naval history all along.
There he is, Jerry Roberts. The book is The British Raid on Essex, The Forgotten Battle of the War of 1812. You can find out a lot more at jrobertshistory.com. Jerry, good stuff, man. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much.
All right, and Karen, good guess. As you can tell, I'm kind of a history nut myself.
Well, I am a little bit too, so there we are.
All right,
we're
good stuff.
Exchanging our passions.
We'll talk to you next week then.
Okay, we will.